the wait until it gets. This is Laura Gray at Jerry Drummy's house on March 17th. Mr. Drummy, can you just say something so we can check it?
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Okay, great. Okay, I'm just waiting for the white to go. I am sitting in the home of Mr. Jerry Drummy, who has agreed without restrictions to his privacy to participate in the Gift of Experience, our oral history project through the Boston Hemophilia Center. And let me start by saying thank you, Mr. Drew. Thank you, Jerry.
You're welcome.
We're sitting in a fantastic room surrounded by Minnie and Mickey Mouses, and I just want to say what a lovely pleasure it is to sit with all this company here. So, Mr. Drummy, let me start by saying it is March 17th, 2005, Wednesday morning, and tell me your date of birth and how old you are and where you were born.
Well, my date of birth was August 8, 1941. I was born in Brighton, Massachusetts.
And you're how old now?
63.
And what kind of hemophilia do you have? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I think they call it type A, I believe.
Type A? Do you think it's factor 8? Type
A? It's factor 8, yes. Positively.
Okay. And do you know the severity of it?
Moderate.
Moderate?
Moderate.
Okay.
I think it used to be, like, worse, but I've just learned to live with it.
Okay. Now, let's start by telling me, who did you grow up with in Brighton?
No, not much of anyone. I had two brothers then. And, we just grew up together.
Your two brothers? And your parents, you mean?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your parents. What were their names, and what did they do, and their education?
My father's name was James. He, I believe it was a long time ago, he worked at the Boston Naval Shipyard, and my mother's name was Marjorie, and then she didn't work at that time. Later on in life, she started working as a nurse's aide.
Okay. What was their education, do you know?
High school, I believe.
High school? And were they from Brighton also?
I don't know where my father was from, but my mother was from Athol, Massachusetts.
Okay. And where were you in line of the three boys?
I was in the middle.
You were in the middle. And were you the only one in the family with hemophilia?
Yes.
So the other two didn't have it?
No, they did not.
Okay. And what about other people, cousins, uncles, anybody else in the family?
Never has been traced. They've tried to and they've looked through, but they never found any trace anywhere else in the family.
So you're really the only one?
That's right.
Okay. Tell me, what is your first memory of hemophilia? Either the word or the experience? Tell me what you remember.
I think my first memory, I was just a small child, and my mother says, oh, we got to go to the hospital for a checkup. And I didn't know why or what or where. And that's like the earliest time I find that I could remember that I had to go to the hospital for something.
Do you remember what hospital you went to?
Yes, Boston Children's.
And so you remember going to Boston Children's Hospital with your mom, and what do you remember about that visit?
I don't remember much about that visit, or maybe I do, I don't know. I just remember a lot of visits, and they all just work into, all blend in together.
But you had a lot of visits to Children's Hospital.
A tremendous amount of visits.
Tell me about what you remember about that. How old were you? When did it start? Or any memories you have about...
Well, I can go back. I can remember probably when I was like 4 doing it. And it wasn't always a very pleasant experience because back then most of the doctors knew very little about it. And unfortunately, many of the doctors thought they were going to discover the whole new thing about it, and frankly, they didn't know what they were doing.
What do you remember about that?
I remember them trying different things.
Like what?
Well, when I was much older, when they when I would have a bleed in a joint like a knee, they'd want to aspirate it. Uh-huh. And they'd keep doing that. They would aspirate it.
And what did aspirate it mean?
To take a large gauge needle and stab it into the joint and squeeze the blood out of it. So they get the swelling down.
What was that like?
Extremely painful. They'd give you a little Novocaine, which wouldn't do anything. And I mean, the start with the joint was bad. It was very painful. And to take something and just stab it in like that. And when I say stab it, they'd have to raise the needle like over their head and like that.
You literally remember someone raising their hand and stabbing
the needle. Very, very clearly. And then the only problem, they would take the fluid out, and the next day, of course, it would just fill up again.
And then what would they do?
They'd want to do it again.
And what was this like for you?
Very painful.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a case that I felt they didn't know what they were doing, and I think in the years that have gone by, they found out that was not the way to treat it. And so there was, you know, many different cases like that that they... I wasn't a person, I was a case.
Is that how you felt? That
yes.
They really didn't,
they didn't
consider
treat me
you
as a
Jerry
person.
Drummy.
They considered me as something wrong and something they were going to find how to treat.
How come you felt like that?
Well, I felt like that because when I didn't want it done, they would keep doing it, and it would keep filling up again, and I would be having the same trouble. The treatment they were giving wasn't doing any good.
What brought you to the hospital? What was your experience with hemophilia? Do you remember as a kid?
Well, what do you mean?
Did you experience many bleeds?
Oh, yes. No, I would have bleeds in most of my joints. What happened? My knees, my ankles, my elbows, shoulders.
Often?
Yes, quite often back then. Or it seemed like it was to me now. I'm sure it was a lot more often then than I have it now. I don't really have that much problem now. I don't know. I've learned to control myself, live with it, and know what I'm doing.
Did you know what the heck was going on when you were a kid? Or did your parents? How'd they figure it out?
Well, I guess when I was about, I think it was 14 months old, I was bleeding in my mouth, whether the tooth was coming in or something, and it just kept bleeding, and it just kept bleeding, and...
Your parents told you this?
Yeah, yes, and so they brought me back, and then back then, Children's Hospital, there was a... one very good doctor there who did discover it was Lewis K. Diamond, who was a very intelligent hematologist. And he knew, he was one of the people who knew something about it, where unfortunately most of the interns they had, it was, you know, just a big discovery to them and, you know, something to experiment on.
So at 14 months you were told that's from a mouth bleed?
Yeah.
Okay. How do you remember your parents handling your bleeds?
Well, I would use ice then as I would now, and you know, and such. And but it was often a case of when I was having trouble to go to the hospital, and then I would probably have like a transfusion, which would treat it pretty well, and you know, it would bring my clotting level up and, you know, help stop the bleeding and such.
Did you spend much time at the hospital?
Yes, an awful lot of time.
What do you remember about an awful lot of time?
Well, for one period of time I can remember I was going in just three times a week just getting transfusions. And, you know, which they were trying then to see, well, how well this would make me feel and treat me, and it did pretty well, but...
How old were you then? Do you remember?
I was 10, maybe a little older, maybe a little younger again.
But still school age?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever spend the night in the hospital?
Oh, I've spent in probably 20 times or better I was kept over in the hospital.
For long, short, day, 2 weeks?
It's hard to say. It seemed like a long time to me now, and it was probably, you know, like a week or something like that. And, you know, it just, as a child, it seemed like a very long time.
Do you remember what it was like when you had to be in the hospital? Do you remember how people treated you? Were you in a big room, a small room?
Oh, it was a ward. It was a ward. In fact, it was not children's as it is today. It was in the old, they had the old bungalows out back in the days when they actually could have some property with grass on it. And but it was like the two floored bungalows, which didn't even have elevators. So when they brought you in, they had to carry you upstairs.
Oh my goodness.
It was archaic, you might say. But then a lot of things were then and such.
So you'd go to the hospital. Why would you be taken? Why would your parents? Who would take you?
My mother, usually.
It was your mother, yes, who usually took you?
And it was because I would be having a bleed or something along that thing. And, you know, sometimes they'd want to just keep me to watch over it and such. And that would usually be the case.
Did it hurt?
It hurt. Extremely painful.
Tell me about pain.
Pain?
What role did pain have in your life?
Just a daily occurrence.
Was it?
Oh, yes. And then it was, like another thing that it was at the hospital was one time I was having, I think it was in the knee at that time, and I went, and I was having a lot of pain. So other times they had given me like some codeine just to fight the pain. And then there was one doctor, I won't mention his name, he tried passing off some sugar pills to me.
Now, how do you know that?
Because he says, oh, take these. These will be better. These are very powerful. These will control the pain completely. But then we saw Dr. Diamond later on in the afternoon there, and he took a look at those, and he was, like, furious.
Really?
Furious. The doctor who gave me those, within a week, he was no longer in the hospital. He was an intern at the time. And
now I'm interested.
Out.
Did you have pain?
Yes.
So it's not as if...
Oh, no. No. Well, anyone could have looked at my knee and see how swollen it was, and no, I was having pain. But it was just, as I say, there was many doctors then who just had their own ideas and experiment, and I wasn't a person, I was a case. And, you know, he was going to prove, well, I can control the pain just by giving him sugar pills, and he'll think the pain has gone away.
Were there other experiences like that that really...
Well, there was lots. Like, physical therapy was a problem back then. They would often, you know, because my joints would be stiff, especially like I was having a lot of trouble in my left arm, so they keep sending me to physical therapy. Now, the physical therapist did not understand what hemophilia was and what caused problems, and so they would keep forcing my elbow and forcing the exercise, and usually by the that night I'd have bleeding in it again. So where I could only straighten it so far, by the time I got through with them, I could straighten it a whole lot less, because it will never straighten again.
So your experience sounds like that you'd go to the hospital and either nothing happened or you got worse.
I said, no, sometimes they would do something and, you know, treatment good, but I would keep running into, as I say, different people had different ideas on how to do it, and they did not really understand what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it created a lot of extremely bad experiences to me until finally it happened at one time. This is when I was in my older teens, and they wanted to aspirate again. I said, no, that's it. I said, I'm out of here. And I left the hospital. I left like the whole system for years.
That was it for you?
Yeah, because I was just tired of doing the same thing, which I was saying this was not working. You know, you're just going to take fluid out of my knee. It's going to kill me. by tomorrow it's going to fill up and I'm going to be in the same place that I started with. So that's what I just said. I just said, that's it, and I left.
But what about the transfusions that you said were helpful?
Well, I just had to give those up because I wasn't going to fight with all these other things that they insisted on doing.
So you didn't feel that you can control what you wanted or what you said no to? You couldn't just say, give me the transfusions.
Right, right. Because the doctor said, well, you know, you're going to, this is the way we're going to treat you and this is how we want to do it. It wasn't what I wanted, it was what they wanted. And it was more or less, quite often the doctor would, there'd be, you know, interns, they'd be fresh out of medical school and such, and, you know, still learning, and they probably never had a hemophiliac before, and all of a sudden, oh boy, this is what I've been waiting for, and I'm going to, you know, really show how good I am by, you know, discovering how to really treat this, which no one else, you know, who probably has a lot more experience than me, know how to do.
How did your parents deal with your being in pain and having bleeds all the time? Do you remember what it was like in the family?
No, I'm sure they felt very bad for me, but I you know, it's a long time ago and I don't really remember.
You don't remember your father or mother saying, don't do this or do
this? Oh, I was told often not to do a lot of things and take it easy and things, but I didn't always stop doing it, but I would control it. Let me get that.
So, when they'd say, oh, Jerry, don't do this, you might get hurt, what did you, were you more careful? Were you a cautious kid?
I was cautious, but I would do a lot of things, you know. You know, to me, the quality of life is a very important thing in what you can do. I mean, if it's all, life is all about what you can't do, then life isn't too great. It's more or less what you can do, and usually I tried to do things, even though I was told, oh, this is bad for you. And because I felt I could prove, yes, I can do a lot of things, even though I, you know, people think it's bad for me, I can still do them.
Like what? Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Well, I wanted to fly a plane, for one thing. And so once I got into my 18 or so, I took flying lessons. And I did get a license out of it. Because, you know, people, oh no, you can't, too dangerous. Don't do it. But I did. So I learned to fly, and that was a fun part of my life.
So, in some way, it sounds like despite the possibility of really getting hurt or doing something that might end up in the hospital, you had some ability to take risks nevertheless.
Oh, yes, yes.
What do you make of that? Where do you think that came from?
I don't know. Maybe it came from a lot of people telling me I can't do this or I can't do that. And in my mind, I figured I can do it. I even spent 1 week up in Canada learning to ski, which
was a no-no. How old were you then?
I was in my, I'd say probably early 20s.
And this was this was during the period you were not getting treatment or anything else?
That's correct.
How did your brothers, did they tease you? Were they nice to you? What did they make of you?
I don't think they thought it was just the way things were, and I don't think they thought, they were good to me, and, you know, it was just the way things were, and they were just used to it, I guess.
So you don't remember them bringing hemophilia up much in relation to you?
No.
Didn't play that much of a role as far as your relationships
went? No, not really.
What about with your mom and dad? Do you remember? Did they talk about it much? How did you even come to understand what it was? Or did you?
Well, I came to understand what it was by always going to the hospital and listening to doctors and everything, knowing what was going on till, you know, I think I got to the stage where I think I knew more than they knew, and I think I did for most of them. I mean, don't get me wrong, there were a lot of very good doctors who I would say did a lot of very good things for me, but there were a lot of, unfortunately, you remember the bad ones a lot easier. Like one time I had an infection in my foot. This was way back when you could actually go swimming in the Charles River, believe it or not, that there was such a time. But even then it was getting pretty polluted, I guess. I had cut my foot and it was treated, but I guess it got infected. I had to go to the hospital. The infection was bad. They admitted me. And then it was the way they treated that. They woke me up in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden they were lancing out my foot without any kind of anesthetic. They said, he's a kid. He won't understand. And so all of a sudden they were just holding me down, cutting into my foot. So that's why I have a lot of bad feelings about hospitals and doctors.
When you stayed in the hospital, did you stay alone? Did your mom stay over with you?
No, I would be alone.
So you were kind of left there as a kid alone to whatever happened to you, happened to you.
Yeah. I'd say something like that. But that's why I say I learned what I could about what was wrong with me. And, of course, most people know their own bodies and their own selves pretty well. And so you learn pretty quick. It's just a way of life, I guess.
What about school and friendships? How did this...
I never went to school. I had all my schooling at home.
How come?
The school system was afraid to take me because they knew I was a hemophiliac. I went probably 6 months. Yes, I went about 6 months to kindergarten. And beyond that, but the school systems were afraid of something would happen to me and they might be responsible and such. And so the city of Boston had a school system with home teachers and such. And so I went through all 12 grades at home.
I am amazed that they wouldn't let you in. I am amazed. So your brothers went off to school and you stayed home every day.
That's correct.
What was that like for you?
Well, that was what I knew. So
that was what you knew.
Yeah, you know, that's the way it was. And, you know, when you're used to doing something, it's the only way you're doing it. You know, you just do it. And you don't think too much about it. I don't think.
And what was it like being homeschooled? Did you have the same teacher over the years?
No, I would have a same teacher for a few years and I'd change to another one. I guess and the teachers were... start with certain grades and different grades.
How did you feel your education was?
Well, I think I finished high school. I was, I think it was okay because I was only 16 or 17 when I finished high school. So I was actually probably a little ahead of my usual age group.
Now, did you go any further in school?
No, I didn't.
You stopped in high school?
Yeah. Well, okay. Mainly, my family did not have much money at that time. And, you know, it was a question of, you know, to go further, it would have been more money than we had to spend. We just did not have much
money. About health care and paying for that? Was that ever an issue with your family? Were you ever costly to your family, or did you feel you were?
I think at some points I probably was, yes. But there was never too much talk about what that was.
So you were never made to feel...
No, it was never made to feel that I was any kind of financial burden or anything.
Were you ever made to feel, or did you ever feel badly that you were causing problems in your family's lives? Or any? Did they ever make you feel bad for getting a bleed?
No, I don't think so. Not at all, no. As I say, this was just, to me, it was just a normal way of life. This is the way it, all my life I was, and so I just never thought, well, gee, it could have been different. This is the way it was.
So you just accepted, this is who I am, this is what it is.
Well, yeah, because there's not a heck of a lot you can do about it if you don't accept who you are and try to do what you can with what you are, you're not going to go anyplace.
But I'm always fascinated, as someone who actually has not grown up with a chronic illness, and I always wonder, you know, how did people accept it? Don't they? Didn't you hate it? Didn't you wish you didn't have it? Didn't you?
I'm sure I did, but, you know, I never really talked that much about it to people, you know. It's just what it was. It was, you know, my problem, not theirs, so I didn't usually put it on anyone else.
Did anybody tease you when you were a kid, or?
No.
Or ask you why you limping, or?
Yeah, people would probably ask me something like that, but I, you know, usually would just shrug it off, and it wasn't really a problem.
Were you disabled as a kid with all these bleeds? Could you still walk, run, use your arms?
I could walk, yes. No, I could. You know, at times I'd be quite normal. Everything would be quite good. Other times I would not be. And, you know, some joints were worse than the others. And at one time, actually, one leg, I even had a brace put on it because it was really very bad, getting very weak. And so,
brace on what?
On my leg, my knee was getting very, very weak in the muscle. So I did have a brace made that I wore for a couple of years.
For a couple of years? Mm-hmm. That's a long time. Yeah. Were you ever in crutches, a wheelchair, that
sort
of stuff?
Yes, I had a wheelchair, and I was often in the wheelchair, and I did have crutches, and I could. Very proficient on crutches, yes.
So it was very visible to people.
At times, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you see, it's a very strange thing. Sometimes, you know, you look, oh boy, you're having trouble. Look at him, he's on crutches. Other times, you know, it could be a month later and I might be walking around just fine. There's no sign of anything. And it was like, it's bad enough what the doctors didn't understand. Most people knew even less than that, so it was just a very strange thing to people. People just didn't know what hemophilia was.
How do you think that affected you psychologically? Do you have any idea of sort of going through this, I'm fine, I'm not, I'm walking, I'm in a wheelchair? What?
I think it made me think a lot more about how to do things, and I will have to look at what the risks are and what I can achieve by doing it, and is the risk worth what I want to do. And I think it's just, you look at it, you have to weigh everything, and then you go ahead and do what you want to do as you can.
So it wasn't so much your parents making those decisions for you that you remember?
No, I think it was me. It was me. I think I got into it, you know, I think I got into it quite early when I could see, well, these doctors are trying to make decisions for me. And
What kind of decisions? Do you remember what they were trying
to do?
Well,
I say, like, giving me treatments.
Oh, treatment decisions. I see.
One like that. And so that's when I think I got into the point where I've got to make my own decisions on most things and figure out what's going to be the best thing for me to do and not what's best for someone else.
So it must have really affected in some ways your relationship with authority figures. Did it?
No, I don't think so because, no. Well, like, I don't consider, like, a doctor an authority figure.
You didn't? Not even as a kid?
Well, maybe originally as a kid I did, but I think I learned more because, as far as I can see, like a doctor, if I have a doctor, he's working for me. I'm not working for him. And his job is to do what I need. My job is not to do what he needs. So I don't really consider him an authority figure, and I think I've got to use his intelligence and what he wants to do, but I have to use it in the context of what my needs are and what I really require, not as a patient, but as a person.
Do you think it led to, in a funny way, more independent thinking for you?
Yes, I do.
You do? In what way?
Well, because I will I would say, well, it probably, again, as you say, authority figures. If someone tells me this is the way something is, I will think about it and try to figure out, well, is this really the way something is or how something has to be done, or can it be done differently? And I will not just take anyone's opinion on how to do something until I think about it myself and say, well, you know, I agree with them or I disagree with them, but I'll want to give thought on my own about what it is.
Mm-hmm. I'm skipping around a little bit, but when you were in the hospital or when you were in a wheelchair, when you were kind of physically unable to run around, mm-hmm. what would you do with your time?
I would read.
Were you a reader?
I was a reader, yes. I would, I used to like to draw one time when I was very young. I used to draw a lot and do things like that, plan ahead. That's probably when I first thought, gee, I'd like to learn to fly, and I like to fly. In fact, I went for years and years thinking that's what I got to do, that's what I want to do. In fact, I never even was in an airplane until I took my first flying lesson.
There's just something about the freedom of flying that you wanted to do.
Because I wanted to do it, and I wanted to say, I can do this.
What happened after you graduated from high school?
After I graduated, well, I got a job for a while in a bookstore. I like to read, so I worked at in Boston at the Old Corner Bookstore, and I worked for like 10 years there.
What'd you do there?
I started out in the stockroom, then I ended up being a sales clerk and actually running a couple of departments in the bookstore.
How were you working in the stockroom with hemophilia, carrying all those heavy books?
I decided I wanted to do it, so I did it.
And it didn't cause you...
No, occasionally I would have some trouble, but as I say, as most things, if you weigh how to do things, and you can find a way of doing things. And
did you tell people you had hemophilia?
Not too many people, just those, like when I worked in the bookstore, the manager knew it, but no one else knew it.
Did you ever tell anybody about it and feel there were negative consequences to telling?
No, I don't think so.
No, that was never your experience.
I don't think so, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, most people that I have even told, a lot of people, even still nowadays, know very little about it. You know, a lot of people have heard about it, and, you know, and they go back to the Russian Tsar, and they knew it was there, and they've heard things here and there. But most, very few people really understand it, what it is, you know. Because they can't understand that, well, at one time you can be in very bad shape, and then a couple weeks later you can be, you know, just fine and have no signs, and people won't even know you even had any trouble, except, you know, I do have stiff joints and a lot of, I'm sure, arthritis is set and such, but no, most people don't really understand it yet.
Tell me just, I want to go back to the pain issue for a minute, because a lot of kids have to manage pain today, and I'm just wondering, how did you do it? What was it like? Do you remember what went through your mind? Did anything go through your mind?
Yes, I wish it stopped hurting.
Would you know when a bleed was coming on?
You get the feeling when it's starting, and as I say, you get to know your body pretty well, and when something is starting to go wrong, you can usually feel it, and you feel it start coming. The fortunate thing about pain is, pain you can forget a lot. You remember pleasure very well, but pain, fortunately, the mind blocks a lot of it out. You can remember that, boy, I had a hard time, I couldn't sleep for 3 days and such, because there was so much pain, but you don't really remember exactly how the pain feels.
Once
it's over, it sort of just, you know, fades away, and, you know, you're just glad when you don't have it, so you don't really, your mind sort of blocks it out. You don't really think that much about it.
What do you think your relationship is to pain today?
An old and disagreeable friend.
And why do you say friend?
Well, enemies don't hang around that much, but, you know, the pain stays. I've had it for some 60 years in one form or another, so, you know, even though you don't like it, you have to sort of consider it your friend because it sticks with you.
What about pain medication?
I take as little as possible.
How come?
Because I don't want to get so I'm dependent on anything, you know, like that. You know, I'll take it when I need it. I will take, you know, if I'm just sort of achy someday and, you know, not bleeding or anything, just sometimes I might be achy, so I'll take some Tylenol or something, and that'll be fine. But then when I really sores up, I will take, like, a Percocet and such, which by not taking it too much, it's quite effective, and it you know, it really helps, but it I know it only helps if you don't take it a lot, because sometimes when I've had like a long session of pain and you're taking them a little more regularly, they sort of lose their effect on you.
Kind of build a resistance.
Yeah, exactly. So it's best to take it as little as you have to.
How did having hemophilia affect your love life? Or did it? Dating?
No, I don't think so. I didn't date a whole lot and such, but I guess I was waiting for the right person to come along, which finally did come along, and I don't think hemophilia affected it.
You weren't worried, oh, I'm limping, some woman isn't going to want me, or I bleed. I mean, that
no,
didn't...
No, that, as I say, you know, you got to play the cards you're dealt. And to worry about something you can do nothing about is just like a waste of time. You know, what is, and if you can't handle it, then you're going to have a problem. So you have to just say, this is the way it is. That's when you start thinking, what can I do with it? How can I handle this? And what's the best course for me to take? That's where it gets to, you think a lot about what course to take.
You did think a lot about that. What course did you take?
I just was me.
Yeah. So you didn't identify yourself as, I am a hemophiliac.
No,
you were Jerry.
I was Jerry
Drummy.
That was just... something like, you know, you have brown hair. You know, it's just another thing, and, you know, no control over it. So I was me, and this is me. And so first you have to like me, then you have to like or dislike any of my problems.
Tell me about meeting women or your wife. Tell me about that.
Well... Actually, I met my wife up in Canada, going to Canada. I worked for a while with this pilgrimage group. This was as a volunteer. My mother had me go up in this pilgrimage up to Saint-Anne-de-Beaupré in Canada.
What's a pilgrimage?
It was a religious novena that they have in July, and a lot of handicapped people would go up to the shrine of Saint-Anne-de-Beaupré.
A lot of handicapped people.
Go there, and my mother had me go there.
For what purpose?
Well, because we're devout Catholics and such, and you just pray, and some people are hoping for a cure and such, and along that. But
all right, now educate me, because I don't understand. So you would go on a pilgrimage to Canada, in hopes, perhaps, that some healing could occur, and who would do the healing?
Well, no one. It was just praying to, you know, God, Saint Anne and such, and you don't really see any people, but, you know, I think it was good for people to learn to live with what they have, maybe. And so I went on that as a child, and later on I was like a volunteer and helping them and working along and helping a lot of the other afflicted people and, you know, people in wheelchairs and such, and I would work along with that. Then my wife, she wasn't my wife then, she volunteered. She was a nurse, actually a student nurse then in Holyoke, Massachusetts. She volunteered, she went along. That's when I first met her, and I met her up in Canada like that. So that's when we first got together. In fact, then we ended up being married up in Canada there.
And tell me a little more about this, about religion and what role that played in your life. Was that a resource to you?
I think so. I think it's a solace and a comfort, you know, when things are really bad and everything, you know, just seems to be going wrong and things aren't working. It's just sort of a comfort, something you can lean on a little bit.
Like what? Tell me.
No. Just,
in the sense that you'd pray, or
you'd pray,
have a philosophy?
You'd probably pray that you can handle what you're being dished out. And I think mainly like that, and just to give you the intelligence, the common sense, the ability just to handle what isn't working right. Or even sometimes maybe just to be thankful for what is working right. You know, just a peace of mind you can get by, you know, having something to believe in.
I'm at a loss for a minute because did you ever see healing go on in any of these pilgrimages? Did you feel people?
I believe it has happened. I can't really say I have ever really seen it. I know it was like at the beginning of that. That's when I had a brace, and then by the next year, the doctor didn't think I required a brace. Now I think a lot was just that I was improving and I was making myself work better, mm-hmm. and such.
When you saw other handicapped people, this is a question. I think some people would go, "Ooh, I don't want to associate with other handicapped people." What was what did your heart say about all of this?
I said, "Hey, for the grace of God, could be me, you know." And at times, probably was me. So no, I sort of welcomed the chance to just help other people that may have had a problem, and something I could do to help them and make their life a little bit better.
Did you think of yourself as handicapped having hemophilia?
Well, yeah, I guess somewhat, but then we're all handicapped in one way or another, you know. You know, you had to go out and say, "I'm going to go in a prize fight," you'd be handicapped against a professional. So, yeah, I guess in some ways, but in, you know, where you are weaker in some areas, you probably get stronger in other areas.
Well, that's an interesting statement, that where you're weaker in some areas, you get stronger in others. Do you think are you defining hemophilia in some ways as the weakness that maybe promoted you to be stronger in other areas?
Yeah, perhaps. I wouldn't say just hemophilia. I'd say anything where that would have been probably for me, it would have been hemophilia, but anything where you're weaker in one area, you improve another area.
We touched upon it a little bit of you're saying you think you're a more independent thinker, or you had to be more pragmatic, mm-hmm. in how you approach things with the risk benefit. Were there any other ways that you can identify where having hemophilia made you stronger?
No, I don't really think of anything.
No. What about the downside of hemophilia? Was there any part of it that you really resented? It sounds like you touched upon the treatment in the hospitals.
Well, I think there's always a problem of when you really can't do something. Like, having trouble with your legs and you can't walk and you can't go someplace or you can't do something, I think that's sort of the downside. That's why I think often now I will do as much as I can when I'm, you know, feeling fine. I will sometimes push it very hard just to enjoy it, because that's the upside of it. And so you just enjoy all the good moments you have, so that way you don't have that many bad moments.
I see. So your sense of appreciation has been heightened, perhaps?
Oh, positively.
Positively. Does that ring a note for you?
Oh, yes, positively. When I can do something, and I do many things, and I really enjoy what I do, and I get a lot of pleasure out of things I like to do because I'm able to do them.
What about the whole 80s period with the HIV and Hep C? Where were you in life at that time?
I was a free and easy person.
You were what?
A free and easy person. I was not going to the hospital. I was, I got married in the 70s.
You got married in 70?
1970 and such.
So you were with your wife, Kathy, when all this started coming up?
Yes.
Did you identify with that at all as far as, oh my, I have hemophilia?
Yes. It was sort of slow because a lot of stuff was very slow and, you know, they didn't know where it was coming from and what was happening. And it was like, it was sort of like the experiences I have gone through, because you had a lot of doctors not knowing what they were really doing. I mean, not that it was their fault, but they just didn't know. And I was fortunately on the sidelines there.
By the sidelines, which mean you were saying you weren't taking factor during this period.
Well, first of all, they didn't have factor in those days. It would have been a whole blood or plasma. But I was not seeing doctors at that time. I was just watching out for myself.
But actually, there was factor now.
There was bioprecipitate that they were starting into. Inside, but they didn't really have factor 8 then.
Okay, and anyway, you didn't have
anything. I wasn't having anything.
Okay, how were you, but were you going to hospitals at all at that point?
No.
Not at all?
No, I had, as I was on the sidelines, I had stepped out of the system because I had too much, wasn't working, and I just stepped out and left it.
Yeah, and you just decided you were going to tolerate your bleeds, period.
Right, because...
And nurse them yourself.
Yeah, and it was more or less, like I say, probably some of the doctors helped me decide that, because they more or less were saying, you know, this is the way we're going to treat you, and you have to do it our way. And
Take it or leave it type of thing?
Yeah, so I left it.
Wow. So therefore, you avoided the co-infections then, is that what you're telling me?
Yes, I was just clear of everything. And it was even, you know, like several years went on until they really figured out that, oh, people are getting this through transfusions. And, you know, fortunately I wasn't getting any transfusions. So I think so many people, actually my age, just out here now, because they stayed in the system.
No question about it.
Yeah.
No question about it. Have you ever had any thoughts about that? Just those bullets that you
dodged? Well, I think that maybe you say, well, maybe, you know, God is watching over me. You know, maybe it wasn't all my decision. Maybe he helped me make it or whatever. But for some reason, I made the right decision. Decision, and I went the way that I felt was the way to go, and it wasn't even knowing anything about HIV. It was just other things were not right and was not being treated right. That's why I left, and I just picked the right time to do it. You know, maybe it was luck. Whatever it was, I'm glad I made the decision then.
Now, you're married to a nurse.
Yes.
How did she feel about your not participating in what medicine had to offer?
Well,
did this cause difficulty?
No, because, as I say, first she had to marry me. Then she had to marry hemophilia. It was me first, and I was what I was, and what I decided, how I was going to live my life and how I was going to do things, this was what I was. And you know, other things you may occasionally agree, not agree. I had no problem. She, you know, understood this is the way I wanted to do things, and she went along with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't really a point of discussion. This was your...
This is the way, this is what I was.
This is how you were going to manage yourself.
Yeah, right. Okay. And at that point, obviously, I probably knew a lot, and I probably still do know a lot more about hemophilia and what the effects it has on people than, you know, she does, or most people. Most people, unless they have it, they don't really know what it's like. They can say a lot of things and, you know, read a lot, but until, you know, you have it, that's when you know what it does and what it can do and what it can't do and what's a myth and what's not a myth. And, you know, some people are very afraid of everything. I can remember once when I was a child, I was going to a hemophiliac meeting and such.
Oh, so you did go to some of those as a kid?
Yeah.
And had children's or?
It was through children's, yes. I'm quite sure it was, but it wasn't held at children's. They would have it at different places and stuff. But I got fed up with a lot of it too, because I can remember just one thing that always stood out in my mind. I was at one of these meetings, and there was parents of someone who had it, and they were, I guess it was a doctor was a speaker or something, and they came out, which I thought was the most ridiculous thing I ever heard, or so it seemed to me at the time. They asked the doctor, said, "Well, my child has hemophilia. Now, do you think it would be a wise thing, so when he eats, make him use a spoon, not let him have a fork, because he may hurt himself with a fork?" Which, you know, you may hurt yourself crossing the street, but you're not going to not cross the street. You know, you do what you want to do. And I think that's why, after that, I think it was soon after that, I took up as a hobby of knife collecting. You know, I said, yes, you know, knives can be dangerous, but only if you cut yourself with them. And if you don't cut yourself with them, they're not going to hurt you at all. But I always remember thinking of a poor kid that's going to, you know, grow up eating with a spoon and not a fork.
So this sense of overprotection was really very unpleasant for you.
Extremely unpleasant, because, you know, you just can't do it. You've got to...
What do you think are the negative effects of overprotecting a person?
I think if you overprotect, then you're not going to do anything. You're going to just hide from everything. Every problem that comes along, you're going to back away from, and you're just not... You're not going to face it. You're not going to face life unless you go out and do it.
Let's move on to, you worked in the bookstore, and then what? Were you able to work in your life?
Well, I worked in the bookstore for 10 years.
Uh-huh.
Then I got married, and the bookstore was a lot of fun, but didn't pay anything. You know, got a lot of books, got to read a lot, and so it was fun. You got to meet a lot of interesting people, but it didn't pay anything. So then I was going to get married, so then I went in with the company as a distributor for women's clothing, which wasn't all that interesting, but it paid okay. So I did that for like, 25 years there. So okay. I worked for like 35 years, and I kept doing that, and I probably would have still been doing it, but they went bankrupt. And so...
Was insurance a concern throughout your life, keeping your health insurance?
No, it wasn't, because my jobs I was in had insurance, and at all work, like when I was working in the bookstore, I wasn't having any really going to the hospital or anything, and I had insurance, and I wasn't really using it. I think the only time I ended up using it was working in that job was I got a very bad strep throat, and then my whole throat was swollen, and I ended up in the hospital for about a week with that until the medication set in and cured the strep throat. And my sore throat was
so
down.
How long did you actually stay away from medicine? Or let me put it this way.
20, 25 years,
30
years.
When did you go back?
Well, I went back when, then finally I was having some kind of a GI bleed on something, and then I went back, and like my blood level of crit was way down then. I was having a bleed from something, and I think it was probably, I had an ulcer working on me, and then I had to go in the hospital. So then I started getting connected up again.
And where was that?
I think then I went to Beth Israel.
To the Beth Israel.
I think it was the Beth Israel.
And
there.
Were you introduced to Factor at that point?
That's when I first had Factor. I think one time before I might have had, I think I had a pulled groin and I had some cryoprecipitate a little earlier than that. And I was just in a very bad shape and I had to go. And I went to Beth Israel then, and I think they gave me some cryoprecipitate, but then when I had the GI bleed, that's when they started with the Factor.
Do you have any idea?
I was in 40s. I was in my 40s. I'd say in my 40s. About 20 years ago.
So in the mid-80s, do you think?
Mid-80s, that's it. Yeah, mid-80s would be about right, yeah.
So you dared try the Factor in the mid-80s, despite...
Oh, yes. Well, because then I went and I talked to doctors, and obviously they had learned a little bit in my absence, and it was obvious they had learned a little bit in my absence, because they knew, like, the things I was talking about that I didn't agree with. They had all said, no, those things did not work. And obviously, they had learned, and then they talk about Factor and how control they had it now and such, and how well they had tested. And
you asked about it.
And they told me, and obviously they knew what they were doing at that point.
What was it like to get Factor?
Like getting anything else, I guess. I've had more needles shoved into me than a needle. I don't even wince if someone shoves a needle into me, because it doesn't, it's just, my veins aren't all that good. I've only got a couple that are really good because they're so scarred up. But it was actually easier than fresh flows of plasma. When they put plasma in, and you could feel it when they shoved it in, you could feel it go right up to you. When it was still cold, you could feel it right through your gums.
Oh my God.
But Factor was just like nothing.
I guess what I'm trying to get to was, did you feel, my goodness, it stops a bleed?
Yes. Okay. No. Oh, no. Yes. No, I think the Factor, the effect a factor, because here finally they knew what was missing my blood. In the earlier days when I had my feeling, they didn't know what was missing. They just knew something was not working, and they had no idea what was missing in the blood. Obviously, at this point, they had got it all separated, and they knew it was factor VIII that was missing, and they tried it on me, and it worked quite well, very well. It was extremely, that's how, so it gave me a new confidence in them, because here, I can sometimes make a good judgment if, these people are right, these people are wrong, and these people are obviously right at this point, because they were talking intelligently. They're giving me something that was obviously working, and they knew why they were giving it to me. They weren't giving it to me because, we're going to try this out and see if it works. You're going to be the guinea pig, and we're going to just watch, but they knew what they were doing at that point.
So it was a whole new ballgame.
It was a whole new ballgame, and then it was... And what happened about 10, 11, 12 years ago, when finally the place I was working for, my legs were really getting, my hips were like going at that point. It was, arthritis and such through it and such. And my hips were hardly working, my legs were hardly working. My knees were getting pretty bad, but I kept on working because, the company I was in weren't the nicest people. And I knew if I went out to have something done, they would have got rid of me somewhere, because they've done this to other people in the company and such. So at that point, though, they did go bankrupt. And then I said, this is time to have something done. And I was going to BI at that point. And the doctor I had said, we could send you to a guy who does, replacements on it, because you could see what shape I was getting. I was sort of getting the point where I was using a cane most of the time. Even sometimes I had to use crutches back then, too. It was getting bad. And so he said, he made an appointment for me with Dr. Brick at...
The Brigham.
And so I said, okay, fine. I went over to him. Actually, about a few years earlier, I went to someone about my knee. My knee was, giving me a lot of trouble at that point. And he couldn't promise me much at that point. He says, we do hips okay, but knees he's been very unsuccessful at. So he says, we could try to do something for your knee, but it'd probably end up worse than you are. So I just said, let's forget that. Yeah. But at this point, so he sent me in to see Dr. Brick. And it was mainly my hips were like really bad then. And Dr. Brick looked at my x-rays, checked me over, and he said, I can fix it for you. Dr. Brick is one of the few doctors from the beginning I had a lot of faith in, and he was, his manner, the way he was talking, what he was saying, he obviously knew what he was talking about, I thought. And he says, I can fix that for you. He says, how would you like to handle it? And I said, right then it was like the hips were very bad. He says, we could do everything, he says, but it's very hard to recover from. And he says, why don't we do your hips? And he said, we could do it one at a time. We could do it, one week, and a week later, do the other one. He says, we can do them both. So I opted. I said, maybe you could really do it. You could do it both, get it done. Because actually my mother had hip surgery, and she had one week later, and it was sort of rough going through that. Once you get one done, you don't want to do the other. And but she recovered very well from her surgery and her hips were pretty good. And I said, and he, Dr. Bick gave me a lot of confidence, and we started, then we clicked up with hematology there, and he started saying more about, yes, with factor, we can do it, and it'll be, you know, it'll all work. You don't have to worry about the problems of an operation like earlier in life. An operation was just, you didn't do it on hemophiliacs. It was a no-no. And so that's when I started to find out more and more about factor and such. And so I had the hips done and such, and it worked out very well.
Did it work out well?
It worked out excellent, you know. I had both hips done. It was, you know, buff. I remember coming out of the anesthetic, the first thing I said to the nurse, did they do both of them? Because I want to go through this again next week. And she says yes, and they worked out well. And then I finally found out after that was done that the physical therapy had improved, that there are physical therapists who know what they're doing and know how far they can push something, and they understand something about hemophiliacs, and you can cause bleeding and you can't overdo it. And it was fortunate, I got a home physical therapist who was a friend of the family, because my daughter was going to school with her kids, and she was a friend of the family, and she was very good. In fact, she ended up, she's only supposed to come like two or three times a week, but she ended up coming 7 days a week to me, because she was a friend, and she lived nearby, and she would come on. And I called her Attila, because she put me through torture. But it was for a purpose, you know. You can go through torture if it's for a purpose and it's achieving what it's supposed to, and she made me do it. And she did a great job, and then it was like my hips really got good, and then at that point I realized how bad my knee really was, because, you know, the hips were so bad, you sort of miss the other thing. And my right leg, I only had about 10 degrees of bend in it. I could hardly move, and it was not straight, it was like this, so I was in very bad shape. So then Dr. Brick, a year later, Dr. Brick said, now we can fix that too. And he warned me, he said, it's a lot more pain than the hips, a lot more pain. And he said, well, we can fix it. You know, both my knees weren't too good, but one was really bad, and it really had, something had to be done. And so I agreed, and he did my knee. And he was absolutely right. It was a lot more pain. But after about 6 weeks of really heavy pain, and then it starts getting better and better and better. And now it's probably my best joint I've got, actually, because it was really wonderful. And of course, the other one, he understands why I don't get it done. And he, like an intelligent doctor, he agrees. It's my decision to where I think it's so bad it really has, because it's not so bad that most of the times I don't even notice it, because I'm just used to it, and it's fine. And he agrees, and even my therapist agrees, yes, because there's a lot of stuff to go through to have it done, that is it worth doing it? And right now I'd say no.
So your experience with medical providers has really gone from night to day.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. No, I, for the most part, for the most part. I have a primary care physician is with the bedside manner of a dead codfish and such. And then, you know, he's like disappointed, I think, sometimes when I come in, because he doesn't find something wrong with me. It's like he wants to find something. But, you know, I only see him a couple times a year, and it doesn't really matter, because, you know, we just have the checkup, and that's it. And, you know, so I, maybe, you know, he's okay, because he's not really doing much of anything for me and just checking out my, you know, blood pressure and blood, I have occasionally blood counts and cholesterol and whatever, which all seems to be pretty good.
How many kids do you have?
One.
One daughter?
One daughter.
And how old is she now?
She's 30, about, she'll be 32 in December.
And her name is?
Ann.
And is she married?
No, she's not.
No children, then?
No children, no.
Do you have any feelings about if Ann were to have children or a child with hemophilia? Have you had any thoughts about, have you thought about that?
Yes, I think I've probably thought a great deal about it. I guess she has too, because she has been tested and she would be a carrier and a very good chance. I think under today's conditions, I think a hemophilia would be off to a much better start because, you know, knowing exactly what's missing in the blood is a whole lot different, so it's not like they have to experiment, they would know exactly what to give someone. So, you know, but as I say, you have to play the cards you're dealt, and so when those cards are dealt, then we'll deal with it. But no, she knows what the whole picture is, and she knows what it is, but no, she's not going with anyone she's intended to marry yet, but, you know, it could happen, and she probably hopes someday she will get married and such, but, you know, it's something we'll deal with when it comes.
Do you have any advice for families today? It's a broad question, I know, but so many families come in and they've either had a family history or haven't, and they hear their child has hemophilia. Do you have any?
Yeah, find out what the child wants to do in life. I mean, not, you know, just right at the moment, but, you know, what they want to achieve, and don't just be too quick to say, you can't do that. You know, control, don't do stupid things, but control. Let them find out, say, I want to do that. Can I do that? And why can't I do that? Because you can do that. And don't be overprotective. They just say, no, your life has to be different than anybody else. Everybody's life is different. But you've got to be able to do what you want to do. You know, what are you living for?
I think so many parents are terrified of having their children hurt or have bleed.
Hurt is a part of life. You know, you're going to get hurt sooner or later. I mean, the biggest part of life is death, because everybody's life is going to end in that sooner or later. And you can fight that all you want, but sooner or later it's going to happen. People, you know, say, I shouldn't go on an airplane because it could be dangerous. Actually, I have had an airplane crash with my wife and child, and I lost power flying a plane. And we had to go down, and I had to put the plane down without any power into a cornfield, which tore the wings off the plane. We rolled over, and we're, like, stuck in the plane for about 5 minutes until people got through the woods to help get us out of it.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, but that's all part of life. And we all walked away from it. I was bruised up from my shoulder to the... Here I had two black eyes where my face went into the dashboard and such. My daughter was... Well, she was asleep at the time, so she just sort of tore her pants and, I think, scraped the knee a little bit, but we all walked away. It was sore for a while, but, you know, but that's just it. You've got to go for what it is, and you have to take the chances. I mean, it wasn't because I did that. Oh, geez, it was terrible, you know. Should never have been doing it. No, it was just part of it.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you or touched upon that you thought about before my coming here?
No, because I didn't know exactly what you wanted to know.
But is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you think would be useful either to families or doctors or social workers?
Well, I think the only thing the doctors and social workers or
nurses
or family is to remember that, first of all, it's a person and not a hemophiliac. First, it's a person. And so you can't just treat hemophilia, you got to treat the person. And the person has got to know what they want and what they want out of life and how they want to do things. And that's got to be very primary. You can't just ignore that part. Just say, we're going to treat hemophilia, and that's the only thing that counts. Because it's not. Because, you know, if the treatment gets more than the life of the person, then the treatment isn't worth, anything. The person's quality of life is the important thing. So they've got to do that. So, you can't just tell people they can't do something, because how do you know they can't do it unless they try? Maybe they can do it, because most people can do a whole lot more than they think they can. And, don't just make it too soft for them, because life isn't soft. You got to play the cards you're dealt with, and you got to play them the best you can. You can't just say, "Oh, I better not do that because that's not easy." Find out if you can do it.
Or if I could get hurt.
Or if you can get hurt, because you can get hurt doing anything. You can avoid everything, and a plane could fall on your head.
Well, Jerry, I think this has been great.
Well, I want to thank you.
And I appreciate your participating in this oral history.
Yeah, I hope it'll be a help.